And now for a song from the Little Red Songbook of the IWW, Dump the Bosses Off Your Back.
Are you poor, forlorn, and hungry? Are there lots of things you lack? Is your life made up of misery? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are your clothes all torn and tattered? Are you living in a shack? Would you have your troubles scattered? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are you almost split asunder? Loaded like a long-eared jack? Fool, why don't you buck like thunder? And dump the bosses off your back. All the agonies you suffer, you can end with one good whack. Stiffen up, you ornery duffer, and dump the bosses off your back.
Welcome one, welcome all, to WOB Radio. This is a broadcast of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the Industrial Workers of the World, a worker-led union of all industries. Going to go ahead and start off here with some introductions to the fellow members currently assembled at the table. Why don't we start off with you, fellow worker Gordon?
Okay, my name is Gordon. I'm a fellow worker from Bremerton. I'm a member of the Tacoma GMB of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW. I've been a Wobbly since 2008. I'm all about working class liberation.
I'm fellow worker Lynn, and I'm a retired person. I've been a Wobbly for about 4 years, and I really like it, and I really believe in it. She, her.
And you're our treasurer.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. The treasurer for the branch, yes.
Yeah.
Marilyn?
Okay, I'm Marilyn, and I am a retired mental health worker. I've been a Wobbly since 2007, and I am a delegate for the branch.
And my name is fellow worker Noah. I use he, him pronouns. I'm also a delegate for the Tacoma branch. I've been a member of the IWW since March of 2021, and I've been a part of WOB Radio pretty much shortly after that, I think sometime in the summer or early fall, right around there. So once again, this is a broadcast from the Tacoma branch of the IWW, and to give us some sections of the preamble, fellow worker Lynn, would you like to do that?
The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. We find that the centering of the management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old.
Thank you so much, fellow worker Lynn. And starting off here today with the first topic on our agenda, we're going to be talking over some labor news today, local strikes, struggles, organizing campaigns that have gone public, and all that fun jazz. Starting off with probably one of the bigger news articles you've probably seen either on social media or maybe on TV, the CEO of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, has been called in to Congress to testify over numerous labor violations. There have been tens and tens, if not hundreds, of labor violations recorded by Starbucks Workers United and the NLRB for union busting related activity from Starbucks corporate. Howard Schultz has gone on record to say that he will not voluntarily negotiate with any union that is organizing in any Starbucks workplace. And as a result of these numerous labor violations, he has finally been subpoenaed. He did not go voluntarily. He has been now officially subpoenaed by Congress to testify over these labor violations. This is pretty big news, especially on the heels of another testimony given by the Teamsters president in Congress just the other day, talking about labor violations and labor organizing as well. That was organized by Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Bernie Sanders will also be overseeing Howard Schultz's testimony as well.
Yay.
So we should expect a good grilling in the news, and it will be very interesting to see the kind of justification Mr. Schultz tries to use in order to justify Starbucks's union busting campaigns.
Ooh, I wonder whether Katie Porter will be one of the ones interviewing him.
Who's Katie Porter now?
Oh, really on fire House member who like grills, you know, these insurance, you know, these CEOs, and like really gets to them and says, so you're saying then that this person should live on XXX, you know, because this is what you pay her per month. How is she supposed to balance childcare?
I think I've seen videos of her online
She's
as well.
Terrific.
You don't want to mess with Katie is the impression I get.
I've seen AOC definitely kind of take up that torch as well.
Oh, yeah.
She does a pretty good job grilling people.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is pretty big news because this is the CEO of a multi-billion dollar worldwide company getting called into Congress over hundreds of labor violations that have been recorded. The Starbucks Workers Union, of course, got started, I think, a couple years ago now and have really taken off in their labor organizing campaigns. There are now hundreds of Starbucks stores that have had union elections and won. There are probably more campaigns on the way. Some of them are finally gone public. Some of them probably still in private. So this is a pretty big sector of the economy to be organizing. Yes, fellow worker Gordon?
And unless anybody in the listening audience is getting deja vu all over again, you might remember that the IWW was involved at the beginning of the Starbucks workers union formation. Our campaigns maybe did not succeed fully, but they planted a lot of seeds and they got a lot of people fired up. And so, you know, our influence as a small radical union outweighs our actual numbers and our actual clout.
Absolutely.
Do any of you around the table remember that when Starbucks first started up, that what they did as a matter of course is they offered shares in the company to every single employee?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that didn't last long, did it?
No.
They also threatened to cut healthcare benefits. Also healthcare benefits that would have been of a special benefit to trans employees who were seeking gender-affirming care through that insurance plan as well.
Important
that was
stuff.
A pretty notorious action that they did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm kind of shocked, but probably shouldn't be, at how there could already be hundreds of these law violations. Why has it taken this long to haul them into Congress?
Partially because money talks.
Yep.
Partially because the process of filing and negotiating and concluding labor violations in this country through the NLRB is a very bureaucratic, very time-consuming, very money-consuming process. The NLRB probably doesn't really have the funding or support that it needs, and there's also the other aspect of labor law not necessarily being directed in favor of the employees and a little bit more in favor of the employers.
Yeah. Essentially, the corporate power mongers can outlast
the employees.
Rank-and-file employees who are trying to organize on their own. And these guys don't want to have big union money behind them. They want to organize their own union.
Absolutely.
And that's the key right there.
So yeah, it'll be interesting to see the testimony coming up from Mr. Schultz. So definitely please be looking at the headlines. And I really have a timetable as to when that's going to happen, but it should happen relatively soon. Mm-hmm. So please keep your eyes and ears out for that. Another labor-related news article that we got going on here. This one is, again, coming out of East Palestine. We've discussed the railway incident and disaster that occurred up there on a huge environmental scale, thousands of people being evacuated, the company stalling any kind of official statement about what they're going to do, offering inadequate help for residents who had to evacuate. Of course, all of this tailing on the end of the rail unions being prevented from striking around January by Congress and their rail employers.
That's some blowback, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is huge blowback because now rail workers, the unions of these rail workers are saying that people are getting sick, the rail workers are getting sick from participating and aiding in the cleanup process of the vinyl chloride, which spilled and then was burned just outside of East Palestine. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg has been on the ground a few times trying to mediate the issue, but a lot of the rail unions are pretty PO'd that, first of all, that the strike was broken. Second of all, that the disaster happened, because they said that a disaster like this could happen. Mm-hmm. And now the cleanup process itself is getting the workers sick as well.
And there's been another train derailment by the same company. Mm-hmm. Now, this one wasn't as severe.
Well, funny enough you say that. More Perfect Union, which is a media page out of Facebook that also promotes and reports on labor-related news, they actually have a rail disaster tracker, and there's two derailments every day in this country.
Mm-hmm. Every day?
Every day. Some of them also including hazardous chemicals.
That's
as
right.
Well. Not on the scale of East Palestine, thank God, yet, but there have been other chemical-related spills since this has happened. Also at the hands of Norfolk Southern, basically.
Could you please reiterate, fellow worker, the name of that website?
It's called More Perfect Union.
Okay. They're
also another labor-related news outlet. They do some fantastic reporting, both on the Starbucks Workers Union, on the train derailment and the rail unions. They do a pretty good job keeping their eyes and ears on labor-related news and activities. So, yeah, I think this just goes, it really shows that this is still going to be a very long-term problem, at least in the context of East Palestine and the rail disaster there. I imagine that because workers are already getting sick, there's probably not adequate enough protections for these workers who are involved in the cleanup.
Oh, but they get one day off a year.
No, they don't have any days
off. Oh, I thought they had one day off. That's what
well,
they were trying to
they
get.
They do, but the way that their sick days worked and the reason why they threatened to go on strike is because you had to use your vacation time to call out sick,
yeah.
And you have to pre-plan your vacation time well ahead before that happens.
Right. So I'm going to get sick in November of 2025, and so
I'm going to schedule a vacation then.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, boss.
And in the meantime, they're finding people with holes in their lungs and their esophagus.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because now, you mean?
Yeah. Because of this disaster.
Oh, yeah, that's poison. That's
and
poison.
It's not just the workers. It's also the people that are forced to live around there.
Right. There's mm-hmm. also, because of the way, I actually talked to my dad. My dad is an environmental scientist. He's mm-hmm. dealt with vinyl chloride and cleanup projects before, or at least he knows about vinyl chloride from previous cleanup projects. And it is definitely a substance that's heavier than water. So what they're finding in a lot of the creeks and streams and rivers around is that immediately after the disaster, on the surface, besides all the dead fish, on the surface of the water looks fine.
Yeah.
But there were videos of people throwing rocks into creeks and rivers, and the second they did that, the vinyl chloride would get disturbed off of the gravel, and it would bloom like an oil sheen mm-hmm. all across the surface of the water.
Oh, my God.
So it's pretty much sinking below the groundwater and into the bases of these rivers and streams immediately outside of it.
In other words, it's hitting the water table.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's down there. And this will be a very, very long cleanup project. So solidarity to the rail workers who are having to deal with a disaster that they tried to prevent. I can't imagine the frustration that they're feeling right now.
I don't see why they should be the ones cleaning up.
That is a very interesting question. This is Norfolk Southern's fault, so they should be the ones employing workers and protecting those workers to clean that up. One other labor-related news article I wanted to talk about, and this is a pretty big one that we've covered a few times before. This is according to The Militant, which is a socialist news weekly published in the interests of the working people. The United Mine Workers of America, the coal miners have returned to work. Their contract fight is still continuing. This is from March 20th. So basically, they were striking for 2 years with an active picket line. It's 23 months to be specific, out of Brookwood, Alabama.
There you go.
And they began the process of returning to work March 2nd. The steps to end the hard-fought strike followed the company's acceptance of the United Mine Worker of America's unconditional offer to return to work, made in mid-February by UMWA President Cecil Roberts.
Unconditional?
Yep.
Yep, unconditional offer to return to work.
Oh, that's sad.
So they have to go back to work.
Cecil's pretty good as far as business unions go. He's a pretty good union representative, but they're constrained, and we've talked about this before too, they're constrained by labor law, which is complex and convoluted.
To give a little bit of backdrop to this, Warrior Met was set up by the biggest outstanding creditors when the previous owner, Jim Walter Resources, declared bankruptcy in 2015. The new owners told miners they had to accept deep cuts in wages, benefits, and working conditions, or the mines would be closed, with a promise to restore cuts as the company got back on its feet. During this strike, the company bosses hired scabs to restart production at Warrior Met's two mines, number 4 and number 7, and at the prep plant in Central Shops. These replacement workers are a combination of experienced miners from other states, as well as Alabama, new workers who recently got their mining papers, and some union members who crossed the picket line. The reason why this strike ultimately failed, and this has been seen countless of times before, is that these big-name capitalists can hire scabs, typically for cheaper than the union workers, and essentially outlast the strike itself. That's why
their pockets are deep, deep, deep.
Yeah, that's how they can strike for 23 months and the union ultimately has to fold. Union members will continue to get strike benefits until they get their first Warrior Met paycheck as of March 2nd. The union picket lines have been taken down, and many of the original 1,100 miners who went on strike in 2021 have gotten other jobs, including at two other union mines in the area. That's how the company won. They were able to just slowly bleed out the union and bide their time and hire scabs. And this is a very disappointing situation, I would say.
Disappointing is not the word. It's outrageous.
Mm-hmm. It's outrageous. I would say that this should be just as big of a story regarding union workers as the East Palestine derailment and cleanup. Mm-hmm. Because this is, a very textbook example of not just the company busting the union, but also the fact that this was such a long strike, and from a pretty rank-and-file strong union, I would say.
You know, it is.
The history of union miners goes back well before even the Battle of Blair Mountain in 1921. They've always had very strong solidarity and very strong support from the community.
It goes back to Mother Jones in the 1890s. Just one observation, fellow worker.
Mm-hmm.
I got to say that I got to send out props to those workers who went out in Alabama, one of the most anti-union, it's a right-to-work state, they hate unionists, they hate unions, they're the most, one of the most backward. I mean, there are other states that are equally anti-union, but Alabama, come on, it's usually got the worst of everything. And so I've got to say props and solidarity with those union miners down there, because that's one place in the world where you can get killed just for having a union card. So.
Absolutely, yeah. Especially just north of there in the Appalachian region as well.
Yeah.
I forget the famous documentary about the miners who went on strike there in the 70s. Gosh, I was...
Bloody Harlan.
Bloody Harlan, thank you. I rewatched that documentary recently, and yeah, it's really surprising just how short of a time ago it was perfectly acceptable to harm and kill union members for being on a picket line.
Yeah. Well, they get dehumanized like the rest of the working class.
Mm-hmm.
If you're dehumanized, that's how they send all these wonderful American boys and girls overseas to murder people, because they teach them that these people that they're murdering are not really quite human anyway.
Right.
They're less than us, that's for sure.
It's the same propaganda repackaged directly towards ourselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very good insight.
And our final piece of labor-related news we'd like to present today, a third REI store out of Cleveland, Ohio, has organized. They successfully won their union vote. This is coming from Cleveland Jewish News. It was posted March 8th, 2023. Quote, workers at REI Incorporated in Orange overwhelmingly voted to join the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, RWDSU, and became the third unionized REI store in that nation, according to a news release. The vote to unionize was conducted by an in-person secret ballot vote March 3rd. The only REI location in the greater Cleveland metropolitan area and overseen by the Cleveland office of the NLRB. The RWDSU will represent about 56 workers at the outdoor sports equipment company in contract negotiations, which will commence this year. According to the release, workers endured an exceptionally harsh union busting campaign that included an attempt by REI to delay their election entirely, in conducting intimidating one-on-one meetings with workers and managers, spreading inaccurate and incomplete information with workers at daily morning huddles run by management, and unlawful surveillance of the workers by outside REI management that descended into Orange from other REI stores, leading to multiple unfair labor practice charges against REI. I'd also like to add on to this, outside of this article, they actually did stage a walkout because of that intimidation of the workers there. It was a one-day walkout by all of the store workers at this location, and they actually won. They got the company to back off right before the election. So good. That really goes to show that not only can you get your union election and win and build solidarity in the shop, but you can also take direct action to make sure that your workers are protected, even if you haven't had your union vote yet.
It's a very good observation, fellow worker. And just for our listeners, I would just like to clarify one thing. I think I've been on this soapbox before, but you'll hear us from time to time throw around some phrases that we know the meaning of, but maybe not the general public. So I'm just going to emphasize that an unfair labor practice, anything could be unfair, but unfair labor practice has a specific meaning in U.S. labor law. And that means the company hindering concerted action amongst the employees. And by concerted action, I mean even talking about a union. If you can get fired just by using the U word, you know, that's unjust. So unfair labor practice fights are legal, but they're hard to win. By the time you get around to winning, everybody's, you know, quit or moved on to a different job. Once again, the capitalists can outlast us often. But once in a while, the sun shines and we get a win. And I'm really happy for the fellow workers in Cleveland at the REI store.
Yeah, it's just like the situation with the Starbucks Workers United. You know, they had hundreds and hundreds of labor violations filed, and now it's all come to a point where the CEO has to testify in front of Congress.
Aww.
So you can win from that more legalistic direction as well. Now, I said that this is the third REI store that is unionized. The first store was out of Soho, New York, and the second store was out of Berkeley, California. These are both retail locations of REI. Actually, all three stores faced very much the same kind of anti-union intimidation tactics by the company. The CEO of REI even made a union-busting podcast at our.rei.com, where he very famously and very hilariously started his little union-busting podcast with a land acknowledgement to the Coast Salish peoples.
Jeez.
So a lovely bit of faux progressivism directed towards breaking up worker solidarity and their right to form a union.
And a new definition of whitewash.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So congratulations to those workers out of Cleveland, Ohio, and we will definitely be keeping you in touch with what's going on with REI organizing.
Solidarity, fellow workers.
Yeah.
Solidarity. And now moving on to our roundtable discussion, we want to talk about a little bit of the differences between the IWW and the AFL-CIO, that's the American Federation of Labor, and Congress of Industrial Unions, which are all formed into one organization. Leading off this conversation, kind of having a couple case studies here in regards to differences in organizing.
Would you talk about Congress of Industrial Unionism? What is that?
The Congress of Industrial Unions was an organization of labor unions formed after the American Federation of Labor. They were a separate collection of unions until they formed together to form one organization. I can't remember the year, to be honest. I think it was sometime in the 40s, I believe.
It was in the late 30s.
Oh, late 30s.
And that was UMWA, by the way, began to organize this.
Oh, really?
At first, it was called the Committee for Industrial Organization, CIO. And then it became the CIO again, but it was the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And they were the horizontal union structure like the IWW is. And we call ourselves an industrial union because we organize by industry, which is one of the differences you're probably going to highlight. But yeah, it got started as an opposite, as it was for the unskilled. In other words, the craft unions put people like steel workers, auto workers, you know, these huge industries in the category of being unskilled. So they formed their own Congress, and unfortunately they got absorbed into the larger AFL in 1954, and they had to purge all their communist and socialist leaders. They had to get rid of, they had to sign loyalty oaths.
Thank you for that bit of back history, though. That's actually really important.
Yeah, I wanted more information about that. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. So I guess kind of talking about in this roundtable today, we want to talk about the differences in the direction of unionism as it stands in the present. So with the IWW, like fellow worker Gordon said, we really do prefer a more horizontal structure to how our union operates. We have much tighter limits on what union officers can and can't do, how funds are appropriated and spent, how union elections are carried out, and most importantly, how we see the role of the worker in the union itself. We want the rank and file worker to be the union and also to have the final say in what the union does. The AFL-CIO is a little bit more structured. They tend to be a little bit more hierarchical, a little bit more bureaucratic, especially in regards to how they function in, with labor law. As we've stated in the preamble, or as I should say, fellow worker Lynn stated in the preamble, we definitely recognize the difference when we talk about the state of relations between workers and management. Again, pulling from the preamble of the Constitution. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another and a set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. And moreover, the trade unions aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. That last part really strikes a nerve with me and the IWW in general, because we are very much a class-conscious organization. We recognize that workers and owners don't have interests in common. Owners want industry, want workers to produce profits for them. Workers have always had the chief concern of making sure that their ability to live a long and happy and well-paid life is insured. And those are very, very different directions in the shop. The other big difference between us and the AFL-CIO is our position and our understanding of labor law. When it comes to labor law, any cursory examination of that history will pretty much tell you that it was almost predominantly written with the intent to aid employers and to help keep the workers in line, to give them a democratic process and bureaucratic process, yes, but very much to stifle the class war, which was very openly taking place up until the early 30s.
You know, it's always been property over people instead of people over property.
Mm-hmm. Or profit over people.
Our whole legal system is written that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The protection of individual property, private property, I should say, the protection of the profits used off of that property, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And so, very much in the early 20th century, there was this big split in the idea of what unions are supposed to do looking forward to the future. The IWW always had a more radical view of it, which is that eventually, one day, capitalism will no longer function as a socioeconomic organization of the means of production, and that we need a union to keep workers organized and to keep production organized after that ends. And the AFL-CIO really doesn't align that way much at all. Like fellow worker Gordon said, there was a history and tradition, especially in the Congress of Industrial Unions, where there was definitely more of an anti-capitalist sentiment. But then in the early 1950s, like you said, 1954, they had to sign loyalty pledges. They had to purge anybody left of center, or at least openly left of center, in order to maintain production and maintain profit for the employers and not to look like a threat to the federal government. Yeah, so there's definitely a big branch here in...
Now, where do you think cooperatives come into all of this?
Worker cooperatives, I've heard some very interesting discussion in this, because the definition of cooperative itself is often defined by the employers.
No, I'm talking about worker cooperative.
Yes. So to be a little bit clear as to what this means, because it kind of gets obscure, obtuse at times, the idea of a worker cooperative, from what I've read and from what I've researched, is the idea that the workers and the managers have to interact with each other cooperatively in an environment where there is some democratic process without a union.
I am thinking of... Oh, go ahead, Gordon. You haven't said anything.
Sure. We're trying to organize just what we're talking about out in Bremerton.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was unfamiliar with it also, because I have a kind of traditionalist view of industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I'm kind of thinking that we're the workers and we're always going to be in opposition with mm-hmm. the employers.
But what if you own the business as workers?
Exactly. And it's just like joining a food co-op,
mm-hmm.
except that you don't have to be middle class to
buy
into
it. Well, it's not a consumer food co-op, it's a worker-owned food co-op.
Or,
big difference.
Or a business.
Yeah.
We're talking about setting up, well, we canvassed our members, soon to be a branch.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have enough people yet, but we found out that there are a couple of members of the union, and they're younger,
mm-hmm.
who are very experienced bicycle mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
They, because guess what? A lot of the younger folks, they
don't drive cars.
They can't afford a car. They can't afford insurance.
Or they don't want it because of environmental climate change.
Yes. Yeah. And so they have e-bikes and they have regular bikes out there. And I thought, well, geez, if we could set up a small shop in either one of those tool sheds that you can buy or in a shipping container that you can also buy. And they're pretty good because they're waterproof. But what I'm getting at is that a workers' co-op means that what would be considered profit gets reinvested into the co-op. And it takes care of people's wages. It takes care of other extended needs. And you can be in cooperation with farm co-ops, food co-ops.
Exactly.
And so we own it. And there's a legal structure that has evolved, sort of like the LLC and all this kind of thing.
And that's something that I'm really interested in. And, of course, it goes back to after the Spanish Civil War, the Mondragon cooperatives.
Yep.
We have a history here with the Grange system.
That's interesting. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
The Grange system. We have several, we have actually, they're growing cooperatives throughout the United States. Mm-hmm. There's the Lobster Fishermen's Co-op cooperative. There is a series actually through the Granges now. Because, you know, that started because the farmers were getting so screwed because of the transportation issues.
The railroads.
The railroads, again. Yeah.
Radically.
Yeah. So they started their own method of getting their goods to market.
Right.
And so that appears to me to be an alternative to the traditional model of unionism. It's all solidarity. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
But it kind of takes the capitalism out of this.
Right. And sort of by definition, it becomes a union shop.
Yeah.
The IWW does look at this kind of stuff
There's
differently.
There's a series of cooperative restaurants in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Really?
Yeah. There's several of them.
I heard of bakeries.
I would like to interject a little bit on this conversation.
Sure.
Because on one hand, the idea of a worker co-ops, of workers having direct control over and being in charge of the decisions made by the business is very much a good thing. It's very promotional of the kind of unionism that we look forward to, which is workers owning the means of production through a more union-based model.
Right.
I think the flip side to this conversation is, does somebody still own, who is the owner of those co-ops at the end of the day, and how those funds are being redistributed back into the company.
I can begin to tell you a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
I have three friends that went to Cuba last month.
Mm-hmm.
And they went as part of a DSA group. And they were looking at cooperatives in Cuba. And what they do in Cuba is, and this is outside of government cooperatives, and the bus system there is cooperative, but that's another story. So what they do there is each worker buys into the cooperative to get it started. So they have to put not only their effort in, but a certain amount of money. They have 3 months where they're working, and the rest of the union or the cooperative members are checking them out and seeing if they're a good fit. If they're slacking off and they're not doing their job or whatever, at the end of the 3 months, they can get their money back and be invited to leave. The workers themselves cooperatively own the business
and the
profits.
I think the one big criticism I have heard of this is that while that is a very good system for one shop or a family of shops that are part of the same kind of worker co-op or a union, ultimately, especially within a more capitalist environment, especially the very capitalist environment of the United States, it does not really branch that further than outside the shop. The collective action begins and ends at the door. So, at least in context of American labor and American unionism, here, having a worker-owned cooperative is great specifically for those workers, but from the IWW's perspective, we're trying to organize all the workers.
Okay, but what about solidarity? So, for instance, in Ohio, there are a number of cooperatives there. There's one that's hospital linen people, because hospitals don't move offshore. So they are a cooperative group that does the linens. So just because it doesn't expand much outside of that particular shop doesn't mean that when they hear X, Y, and Z going down, that they don't lend their solidarity. Mm-hmm. And that does lend strength to the movement. You're not counting solidarity across lines.
Okay.
Gordon's got something.
Also, to expand on what you said earlier about the Mondragon collectives in Spain.
Yeah.
They have 250,000 people, mm-hmm. or some huge amount of people.
Yeah, they do.
And that spans industries.
Yeah.
So, in
start
a sense,
somewhere.
Well, yeah. So, if I want to organize my shop, mm-hmm. which could be a sandwich shop that serves the factory workers, doesn't matter,
mm-hmm.
and we organize that, we can also affiliate in a federation model, right? Not the United States federal government, but federating amongst each other so that we can act in concert as separate unions that get together within this collective structure. Now, they had to fight for that, and I think Mondragon was started by a Catholic priest or something.
Murky past, I don't know.
Right, but it started as sort of a neighborhood thing,
mm-hmm.
right? And now it's 250,000 people or more,
right?
And they are able to function politically as a unit.
Yes.
By getting the solidarity, you know, if one of us goes out, all of us go out.
Right.
And so, and they deal with their competitors, they deal with suppliers, they deal with the Spanish government.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're protected, you know, because if they tried to suppress that, you'd have 250,000 people on your hands who have been used to getting decent pay and decent treatment.
Yeah.
And so that's revolutionary stuff right there. So it's possible. It's possible for these separate bargaining units, if you will,
mm-hmm.
to, and once again, we have to use the terminology of the U.S. labor movement so that we can get people to understand. But in a sense, that's like collective bargaining.
Yeah.
Because we have strength. So in a model like Mondragon, it is because they're federated and they span trades.
I can definitely see the point. And from a more specific IWW perspective, it wouldn't be a collection of unions. It would be one big union of all industries.
Right.
Yeah.
So you would, I guess, to kind of to adapt that model would be having multiple union branches of specifically industries coming mm-hmm. together
exactly.
to deal with things like organizing production and organizing distribution and stuff like that.
But you got to start somewhere.
I guess my final question to this is, do worker co-ops negate the necessity of a union?
Because that's a good question.
Some people do make arguments for that. Some people do make arguments against that. And like I was trying to say at the beginning of this, there are a lot of worker-owned co-ops or member-owned co-ops that are not directly being controlled by the workers.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Case in point, like we talked about with Labor News today, REI is a membership co-op. People
right.
buy memberships to get discounts on what they're consuming.
And that's what the co-op on Pearl Street is. I also learned, because I thought Winco was a worker-owned co-op.
I just went in there yesterday. They had a big banner. Sign. We're a worker-owned company. What does that mean?
They use the language, but they don't walk
exactly.
the walk.
Exactly.
They like that greenwashing,
yeah,
or whatever one can call it, or blue collar washing or whatever. But what they do is they appropriate the language of progressives and they use that language to keep this business as usual.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's what I kind of wanted to drive home, is the fact that unless it's a worker co-op in the sense that the workers are organized as a union outfit and have control over how production is managed and how profit or production is redistributed back to the workers, then it's not a real co-op, especially not from the perspective of the workers or the IWW.
Yeah.
Thank you for that conversation. I think that will be really beneficial to the listeners
yeah.
because there is a lot of talk about, well, what about worker co-ops? How can mm-hmm. this help
mm-hmm.
counter all of the...
Well, it's another possibility for equity
mm-hmm.
that is not fully being explored, but just as I'm seeing, like, Pierce County Labor Council has come a long ways. They used to be very down on the IWW,
mm-hmm.
and now they're looking at industrial unionism,
mm-hmm.
and they're saying, maybe it's time for that.
Yep.
So I think it's time for us to have open minds at looking at alternatives for a lot of the ways we've historically done things.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, that's all I want to say about that.
No, absolutely. And I think that the values of the IWW have begun to bleed over into the AFL-CIO,
exactly.
Like we've seen with Teamsters for a Democratic mm-hmm. Union,
yep.
Like we've seen with other similar organizations.
But you know what we haven't said in this particular recording today
mm-hmm.
is we haven't brought up the fact that the AFL-CIO originally, one way that it was totally different from the IWW was that it did not allow people of color into the union.
Ooh, yes.
Or women.
Or women, yes.
Half the population.
Right. So
right.
It doesn't have the same history that our good old IWW has. And that's all I'm going to say about that because
they probably took that page out of our book as well.
What's that?
They probably took that page out of our book
yeah,
as well, yeah.
Because I don't want to beat the listener over the head with what he already knows. So.
Well, maybe not. I mean, you know, the whole purpose of WOB Radio is to educate listeners on labor history and labor law and labor news that they don't usually hear about. So,
yeah.
No, they do need to hear that.
One additional point is that you guys know that I went up to Bellingham for
yes.
OT 101.
Yes, how was it?
It was excellent, and it has evolved over the years because I flunked mm-hmm. a couple of them.
Yeah.
But what they said at the outset on day one, on Saturday at 9 o'clock in the morning, they wrote on the whiteboard, and they were talking like we're talking now. Well, what's the difference? Why do we need this mm-hmm. kind of union? And what the trainers stressed, and shout out to fellow worker Tegan and fellow worker Bob from the Seattle branch, who did a wonderful job of facilitating that training. They said our union has like a little slogan. It's our unionism is direct, it's democratic, and it's caring, meaning that we look out for each other.
Mm-hmm.
We're not just I pay my dues to the Central Labor Council or whatever, and I go to a meeting once in a while, if they let me in. They care about me. They reach out. I might be having trouble with my marriage. I might be having trouble with health concerns. And they would reach out. So it's more of a community thing than just your traditional labor union. Direct, democratic, and caring.
It's about creating a culture and an environment where the working class can support each other in whatever way that
well
they
put.
Can.
Well put, fellow worker.
Absolutely. I remember my OT 101 training too. They had said that exact same thing.
But I do want to do a shout out for Patty Rose, who just retired as the secretary of the Pierce County Labor Council,
mm-hmm.
because she was a wonderful secretary for well over 20-something years, totally welcoming, totally caring.
Mm-hmm.
She had her act together, and I'm going to miss her. She was very good to Jobs with Justice,
mm-hmm.
and she was very inclusive. And she's down in Florida riding her motorcycle.
She was the glue.
I guess to kind of close out this section, if we are going to close out this section, this is not to say that the IWW is in conflict with the AFL-CIO. We have a different philosophy. We have a different idea of what unionism is supposed to look like
right.
and the direction. But at the end of the day, we're all fellow workers. And just because we have these bureaucratic or legalistic disagreements with each other, which we definitely hold our positions on, that does not mean that we will not stand up for members of other unions outside of the IWW.
Hell yeah.
All workers.
Because it's not about organizing under a particular union or a particular
it's
ideology.
It's about solidarity for workers.
It is about organizing on the basis of the working class.
Class interest.
It is class-conscious unionism, and as we've said before, we're definitely seeing more of that in the AFL-CIO, and we welcome that change in direction. And if you'd like to submit any potential questions, comments, or even other ideas for a roundtable discussion in the future, you can always check out our Facebook page, which is also WOB Radio on Facebook, and you can send us a direct message or you can add a comment on something we've posted, and we'll be happy to get back to you if you want to hear something on the airwaves about unionism or the IWW that you want to hear discussed. So thank you. And now for some reporting out of the good old Kitsap Peninsula, we have fellow worker Gordon giving us Kitsap Labor Notes. Take it away.
Listeners, welcome to the broadcast. I'm going to give you a little bit of news, not a whole lot, but a little bit of news from that wonderful land across the Narrows Bridge, Kitsap County and Bremerton in particular. And what's going on out there is that we're building the union, we're building the IWW in Kitsap County. And, you know, surrounding environments, principally centered in Bremerton. we're attracting a lot and a variety of people, at least our age demographic. Well, I'm the oldest guy there, so and it goes down to a young person who's 22 years old. And we almost have enough red cards. Our internal law or our internal regulation says if you get 10 red cards, you can get chartered as a branch. So what we're trying to do is build the union, and we're focusing on local labor disputes, and we're focusing on where we could be most useful. And so what we've done is we've allied with a couple of similar thinking groups. We're working a lot with Food Not Bombs, which is a really good outfit. They're all over the country. What they do is that they serve people healthy food who cannot get healthy food because they're either, usually they're unhoused or they're living in very marginal circumstances. A lot of people are living in RVs. There's a bunch of cars down on MLK Way in Bremerton that people are living out of. And it's just a really horrendous thing. So we've been working with Food Not Bombs. And as a matter of fact, we picked up a couple of new red cards directly out of Food Not Bombs to show you that community organizing in the sense that Food Not Bombs does and labor organizing can really intersect. Because the IWW looks at unhoused people as temporarily unemployed and unhoused fellow workers. What we're doing is we're having a movie night, and it's going to happen at the Charleston Theater, locally known as The Chuck, and usually The Chuck has punk rock and folk punk, which I never even knew existed.
It's a wonderful genre.
It is. It's great. It's kind of like a Rude Mechanical Orchestra or Window-Smashing Job Creators out of Olympia.
Mm-hmm.
Those are names of bands?
Those are names of... Oh, you ain't heard names of bands.
I thought those were actions I was supposed to take.
How about Wingnut Dishwashers Union?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, and what was it? Truck Bed Boys. So they have a lot of... And I'm not a punk rocker, but I've been to a concert or two. They get these bands that are, you know, they're living on fumes and handouts. They need transportation money. They usually don't charge at the gate, you know, or there's a suggested donation. So anyway, we're working with Food Not Bombs, and we're having a movie night. And the movie we're going to be showing is a Ken Loach film. Ken Loach is a great director out of the UK, and it's called Bread and Roses. So that's going to happen.
One of my favorite songs.
It's a great song, and it's a great title for the movie, too. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be opening the doors at the Charleston Theater, which you can look up online, Charleston Theater, Bremerton, and it'll tell you the address. It's hard to miss. Okay, the day is going to be May Day. What do you know? We got a venue for May Day. And we're going to be showing this because the Charleston Theater originally was a World War II movie house. So they have a full movie screen that we can use.
Just to clarify for the listeners,
sure.
It's going to be taking place May Day. Do you have a time?
Yeah. Doors opening at 6:30 p.m. and the movie's going to roll at 7. And there will be free munchies for people to have. And we're going to have a can that we hope thousands of dollars are going to be poured into. But nobody's going to get turned away for lack of funds. That's a typical wobbly thing. You know, we invite everybody. If you can afford a few bucks at the door, we welcome any kind of contributions. Also, food donations and warm clothing donations are welcome. So come on out to B-Town. It's easy to find. It's right there. And you're going to have to hunt around a little bit for parking, but there's parking available on the street. So come on out to Bremerton. And if you need any more information... Fellow worker Sean has given me this phone number that I can announce. Sean's phone number is 360-471-5982. And if you have any questions or need to know how to get there or whatever, you can call fellow worker Sean.
Do you think that maybe some groups that are like-minded might be able to table there?
It's a possibility. We did table the last time we had at the mm-hmm. punk concert
right.
venue. We had a table, Food Not Bombs had a table, Pacific Northwest Harm Reduction.
That's a good one.
That's a good outfit because these are the people that are given needle exchanges and they're given hygiene products and they're given aid and comfort to people who are basically living on the street.
So, do you know a little of the history of Food Not Bombs?
A little bit. It's mostly it's an anarchist outfit.
It started on the East Coast.
I think so.
As a result of, I think it might have been Three Mile Island. And their whole purpose was for peacemaking, food, yes. Not bombs.
Yes.
And the history was of dumpster diving because we are a land of plenty.
Mm-hmm.
And getting food dumpster diving and serving it in solidarity and commonality
mm-hmm.
with people who either were economically stressed or they also went to events and provided all the food. Yes.
I would just like to clarify, when you're saying dumpster diving, and I've also looked into this as well, they're not taking spoiled old food and serving it up.
Right.
What we're talking about is food that has been thrown away.
I would have gotten there. Yeah.
Food that has been thrown away that is well before its expiration date that a lot of local stores tended to throw out
yeah.
simply because it wasn't selling or simply because they wanted to replace it with another product.
Okay. And also, they historically only serve vegan food.
Mm-hmm. That's historical.
Yeah.
I was going to bring that up because their outlook has changed a little bit.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I respect vegan people and mm-hmm. and I respect their motivation mm-hmm. both for health and for animal cruelty and
yeah.
ethics like that. But they've come to realize that we can't always have vegan food, and that a lot of the people living on the street, they're looking around for some chicken wings or something mm-hmm. substantial. Mm-hmm. So I really admire the fact that these, and they're mostly way younger than me, mm-hmm. but they're mostly young people who have decided that they're going to make an exception to their personal mm-hmm. ethics in order to get more food to more people.
Right.
Absolutely. And
so here in Tacoma, they used to be called Food Not Bombs,
mm-hmm.
but currently they're being called Serve the People.
Yes.
Which is an old Black Panther Party expression.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a slogan of the Black Panther
so
Party.
So if the listener is in the Tacoma area and they'd like to contact Serve the People, I know the Black Panthers are doing daily and weekly feeds,
mm-hmm.
and they're doing that in historically marginalized neighborhoods. And they would welcome the help or the donations.
Yeah, donations. And like I'm saying, they're not as doctrinaire as they used to
right.
be. So they'll take canned goods, they'll take mm-hmm. ramen packages, they'll take anything that's in good shape, you know, and hopefully before the full day.
I was involved with it when it was Food Not Bombs here in Tacoma. And we did our dumpster diving. Sorry, Noah. And some of this stuff may have been a day over the expiration
right.
date.
There you go.
But it was perfectly good food.
Yeah. Yes.
And we had one kitchen where we got and we worked every week. And we didn't use any paper plates or any paper products. We had to haul all those dishes back
wow.
and wash them because it was more purist, and it was always vegan.
Right.
Yeah.
It's changed a little bit.
Yeah.
I welcome that change because I respect vegans and I respect veganism, but mm-hmm. I'm not one.
Yeah.
And so,
but anyhow, you know. What I wanted to get to is Food Not Bombs is doing great. It's alive and well,
mm-hmm.
and the listener could definitely support that.
Sure.
Yeah.
And
I didn't mean to cut into your...
Oh, no. Yeah. It's all right. This is... We like yeah. to interact.
Yeah, I do, too. I do, too.
So I've got, are we done with this?
Oh, no, keep going if you want to keep going.
I've got one other little item that's coming out of Kitsap County. And what we've done is we've gotten together, we've talked about worker co-ops. I mentioned earlier the possibility of having a worker co-op bicycle shop, which I personally would have great joy, because I get to work my old trade, which is being a machinist, on slightly bigger things like aircraft carriers, but... the principles are the same. So I like mechanical work. I like metal trades, and I like to teach young people who don't get this kind of training
oh,
anymore.
Good for you.
And you know, just simple how to use a tool without cutting your arm off or drilling a hole in the back of your hand. You know, and a lot of people just simply are not acquainted with industrial processes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a wonderful thing for me to get involved with. I'll feel like I'm back on the waterfront and not a useless old retiree. So, but the other thing that we're talking about is a real estate collective. We have talked about tiny houses. We found out through our research out there, and there's a couple of people who are really, really well versed about it. I'm not, but I of course I support it. But they found a bunch of these tiny houses, you know, which are basically glorified tool sheds
mm-hmm.
that are set up to be decent housing and shelter for people who have none.
Mm-hmm.
We found like 15 of them that are sitting on some church parking lot because they can't get the... And they're completed. They're finished.
Right.
They're done. They're waiting to be deployed. And as we all know, if we don't live in a house, it can go to ruin just by not having people inside and the heat going and all
so
this kind of stuff.
So you're trying to buy real estate in common?
Yes. And we're going to set up a village, okay? And we're going to be using alternative housing construction, either that or prefabbed little houses. We're going to decide as a collective how we want to do that. And pretty much open-ended. And we have another young woman who joined the outfit, and she is a public service lawyer. So we have two lawyers in one wobbly outfit. That could be dangerous. But anyway, these are the people that I trust to know about zoning and all the...
Have you opened a bank account yet?
Today? Not yet. We're still formulating that.
Because I want to donate immediately.
Give us all your money. We'll build a hotel for people without housing. But what I'm getting at is that these are alternative models.
Yeah.
And the barriers will be thrown up almost immediately.
Of course they
When
will.
You talk about real estate people and you say collective, ooh, that's like, you know, ringing the fire bell. They'll come right down on us and they'll get the city, oh, well, you're not zoned here for this and you don't have permits for that.
Because they can't make the money off of it.
That's exactly right, fellow worker. You see right through this.
Well, and also the systems want to have one owner rather than a collective.
Yes, they don't like that word collective. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying is that look at an LLC. That's a collective for rich people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a bunch of lawyers who want to avoid taxation as a corporation. So it's a limited liability corporation or a limited liability partnership. There, what I'm saying is that there are structures in place that we can utilize for a bunch of, you know, dirty homeless commies living out there on the street. We can adopt the models that already exist. So we're going to, this is very much in process, but we're having a meeting at 6 p.m. March 31st. That's this month. At 3650 Kitsap Way. 3650 Kitsap Way at 6 p.m. If you want to come and observe, and if you have some experience with this area, pipe up and let us know. Everybody's welcome. So
that's in Bremerton.
Yes, in Bremerton.
That's May 31st.
March 31st.
March 31st. Yep.
And so it's we're getting some of these things percolating out there, and we have a really good group that's about ready to form a branch. I'm still going to drag my butt over to Tacoma to participate in the WOB Radio Hour because I'm such an egotist. I love being on the air, and it's going to be interesting.
You add a lot to WOB Radio because you've got the history.
Oh well, I try.
Is that a nice way of saying he's old?
It is a nice way of saying
it's a breath mint and a laxative.
There we go.
Two mints in one. Oh my God. Now we're really showing our age. Jeez. But anyway, I'm very happy to bring this news about the Kitsap Peninsula and Bremerton and environs. And look out for us. We're going to be changing the scene out there. We've already gone on the radar by picketing the Starvation Army. So we're already on the radar out there. That's unheard of.
Now, just to wrap this up,
sure.
We're getting to that point. Can fellow listeners or fellow workers also reach out to Sean as well if they're interested in joining the nascent Bremerton branch?
I would say so because Sean is, I don't know how he handles it, but he's pretty open with his phone number since we don't have a branch yet.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have
And that's the 360-471-5981?
By golly, you got it copied down correctly, fellow worker. You're pretty good.
Okay.
So that's it from me, and come on out to Kitsap.
I'm excited.
Good. Hey, I'm very happy. I didn't think of this stuff. I've been Sean and the boys and girls out there have done more organizing in the past 10 months than I did in 10 years. I'm ashamed to say.
Well, they've got the energy and the dissatisfaction because it's their current working conditions.
And no one worker can do it alone.
That's true.
Don't put too much weight on your shoulders.
It's all my fault, man.
I am very much in the same vein of like, I want to volunteer and donate to everything. And
right.
Now I'm burnt out and poor.
No money and tired.
So yeah. But we look forward
to... You do need your fellow workers' solidarity to get any of this stuff done. So we're working on it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that.
And you're listening to Radio Tacoma, 101.9 FM, KTAH, LP Tacoma.
And now fellow worker Lynn is going to talk a little bit about International Women's Day and women in the working class. Take it away, Lynn.
All right. Well, this is just a brief little segment about women. This past week was International Women's Day, but I consider it the day, the week, international day, week, month, year, century of women. half of the world. All right, so currently, you know, in the immediate past, we've had some major, major events happen. Roe versus Wade was overturned. There's now the risk of abortion pill being illegal. There's risk of contraception even being illegal. There's the possibility of immediately of the morning after pill being taken away from us as needed. There's just a lot going on around the world. The women of Iran are continuing to protest and march for the wrongs being done to them daily. Empowering women helps society. There are fewer births, healthier children, more education, more food, and more time for the family members. And education, empowering women, dispels myths about health care, pregnancy, birth, etc. Educates. Empowering women involves educating family planning, nutrition, water purity. Women deserve this. I have a friend who's a retired, he was a doctor in another country, and in Africa. He learned that if they dug wells for the people, that using the local rivers, the local watering holes, causing fatal diarrhea for many, many, many children in the villages. And but it turned out that where he was working, nurses had tracked this diarrhea and the people that were affected, where they lived, for many, many years. And so it was really helpful evidence that if the people had just their own source of good drinking water, the diarrhea almost disappeared. The IWW has always welcomed and embraced women, but not only women. Unlike many other unions, they have embraced Black, Jewish, Irish, Greek, Italian, every person of color that they used to be considered by some of the Caucasian workers in this country as less valuable humans.
Oh, and LGBTQI too.
You're right. So you're right. Just a little bit of history. Imagine that no men were allowed to vote until 144 years later in 1920. Think about that. Also, Black Americans, exactly 100 years after the end of the Civil War, where they got the right to be, quote, human in a society, till they could vote. So my urging is to get involved with what's going on in the world, get involved in your local community, vote, and together and with the IWW, we can change the world. I mean, literally, step by step. Like those in the past, we who love and seek social, health, legal, and financial equity and justice must persist in demanding and creating these things.
And just to give a bit of context on International Women's Day as well, it used to be International Working Women's Day, just like there used to be International Working Men's Day. Mm-hmm. And that language was definitely etched out over time as it was seen as being too class conscious and too much focusing on labor and employer relations and how socioeconomic class plays into it as well. So
if a woman happens to work inside her home, raising her children and keeping her family fed and clothed, etc., she is a worker too.
Yep.
Absolutely.
So it's not just paid workers.
And we say that. We've said that for a long time in the IWW as well, that the unpaid work of women keeps the world turning. I mean, you can imagine if you could ever put a dollar amount to it, it would be trillions and trillions of dollars of unpaid labor just to keep the house together, just to make sure that the children are raised.
I put up a little Facebook meme, mm-hmm. Women hold up half the sky, and I got a lot of feedback from women who were saying, no, we do more than half the work. We do 66% more work for the family than males, generally, in the home. And they receive somewhere around a third less of the income because we still don't have the Equal Rights Amendment. And I was listening to a program last night on Channel 9. It was being programmed out of Austin. I tuned in late, so I didn't get to hear who the politician was. But she had four women up on the podium with her. And one woman was talking about this, and it just curdled my blood. So think about this. The, quote, right-to-lifers that have been so oblivious to the need for safe therapeutic abortions. This one woman wanted to have children, had to do IVF, in vitro fertilization, was delighted that she was carrying her baby. Ended up, because of cervix insufficiency, her water broke early. Because it was Texas, folks.
Oh, God.
The hospital said, we can't terminate this pregnancy, even though your baby is not going to make it. We have to wait till either it's life-threatening to you or your baby starts to come out. Mm-hmm. So she had to go 3 weeks not knowing what was going to be happening. Finally, she went into toxic shock, at which point they were able to do an abortion.
Simply because she was going to die.
Because she was going to die. Women are going to die. Women who want babies. Is this pro-life?
There's actually a similar case like that out of Idaho just a couple months back as well, where a woman was having a miscarriage, but because it didn't technically meet the new state restrictions on abortion, she had to wait 3 weeks in miscarriage before she could have a DNC.
Yeah.
These new laws are going to kill women, and they're going to affect family lives, and it's all political.
Mm-hmm.
It's somebody's political interpretation.
That's and not it's pro-life.
Outrageous. No, it isn't. And it's outrageous to think that I could, okay, if they want to go that far, I could be chemically castrated. You know, mm-hmm. I could be, you know, chemically or sterilized because I'm undesirable or whatever. And here we're right back.
But you can get your eugenics over the TV.
Oh, yeah, don't worry about me, baby. I'm still solid.
And she'll like it, too.
Yeah, no, there is definitely an irony in the fact that, you know, I could walk into my doctor's office and probably get a referral for a vasectomy in a week, but in order for women to find short-term or even long-term forms of birth control, abortion access, and even outside of, you know, violation of bodily autonomy, the discrepancy
it's
in wages.
It's the handmaid's tale.
The discrepancy in benefits, the discrepancy in housing availability, the discrepancy in both legal and social support for women. I mean, just because we are an industrialized country does not mean that women exactly, you know, have it all. Yes, Lynn?
Well, and there's the huge factor that so many women are not aware of, are not taught that if they're not out in the workforce, they're not earning their own Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they, let's say, get married
good
at 20,
and
they're married for 40, 50, you know, until they retire, until their husband retires, or that maybe they never marry, or they're divorced. Ideally, throughout your whole ability to work life, you are earning that for your future and paying into Medicare. But if you don't have that option, then when you get older, you're going to be one of the many women who are outlive the men, be it a husband or whatever, a partner, or a female partner. But anyway, you regret that you didn't understand the laws about. So you needed to have a career, you need to have options, whether it be through college or vocational, but there's a lot of training that needs to be done to women, for women and others, about their futures. It includes training in economics, finances, as well as... another point that I wanted to make was these laws with abortion. There's a creeping religiosity that is coming into our government more and more and more. And so the Christians, the extreme Christians, in my opinion, have wanted to outlaw abortion forever, and they've gotten their way now. And to me, there's just this influence is coming into many things, including end-of-life decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And women outlive men, and so this affects many aspects of our society. But anyway, creeping religiosity is, to me, a very frightening aspect of our current politics and society.
Absolutely.
Good point.
To bring this from an LGBT perspective as well, the attacks especially directed towards trans people are also especially directed towards trans women, due to a lot of transphobic rhetoric currently in politics and society being directed towards them predominantly. Not entirely, but predominantly. So a lot of trans women in this country are also suffering because there are now anti-drag laws that are passed. But the side effect of that is to these conservative religious legislators and the police departments that are going to be enforcing these laws, to them there is no difference between a trans woman and a drag queen. So basically by criminalizing drag, they will be
criminalizing
trans people being out in public as themselves.
And the murder rate for trans
women, especially trans women of color, is high.
It's very high.
High, along with the poverty rates as well. Mm-hmm. We're also seeing other laws restricting access to gender-affirming care. I believe it was North Dakota that just passed a law saying that any minor that hasn't started on any kind of hormone blockers or even just counseling has to be weaned off of it, which will essentially result in a lot of dead children and a lot of children who are feeling unsafe and are under mental distress because they have no outlet for themselves to be themselves. So this attack is coming from very much multiple points in the political, in the religious, in the social spectrum, and it all ties into the long, long history of women's oppression and the long, long history of women's liberation as well.
So to get back to that...
Mm-hmm.
You know, that line from the song Bread and Roses, mm-hmm. which is, the rising of the women means the rising of the race, meaning the human race.
Mm-hmm.
So as we work for our own liberation and freedom mm-hmm. and equity, we are naturally working for all of those rights. Thank you, Lynn.
All right. Moving on to our next section here, we have the environment report from fellow worker Marilyn. Marilyn, whenever you're ready.
I am ready. So for this month's section of WOB Radio, I was asked to explain to the listener what environmental unionism is, what it means, and to distinguish it from environmental racism. Which I'll try to do, but I also wanted to cover a few current green unionism news items, too, mm-hmm. that are happening, and to give a shout out to one of my sheroes who died this month in 1997. So because concepts like environmental justice, environmental racism, ecology, and green unionism are so broad and may mean different things to different people, I wanted to start out with a brief explanation of terms just so everybody's clear. I can hope that it'll be clear. It would take a whole book to really get into this, and you don't want to listen to me for that long. According to the Toronto Socialist Project publication, say that three times, the publication's called The Bullet. And I was looking at the March 2023 article titled Manifesto for Eco-Social Energy Transition. And this is quotes. Environmentalism is a social movement that seeks to influence the political process by lobbying, activism, education, and protecting the natural relations between humans and natural systems on which they depend, such that all components are accorded a proper degree of sustainability, end of quote. I feel that's a good start, but I would like to add respect to that too. Respect toward the earth and understanding that humans and other life forms cannot live without a livable planet. So environmental unionism has two major components. One, to promote safety and sustainability in the workplace. This would include safety from gender, racial, ageist, immigration, and disability slurs and harassment. And the second thing is to promote sustainability of the job itself. So if a logging company cuts down all the trees in a forest and doesn't replant, soon there are no more trees and no more logging jobs. Then they often relocate to a third world country, which we are fast becoming, where they can pay much cheaper wages and continue their extractive practices and lay waste to more land till there's no land left. If you extract all the oil shale from the planet and ruin the soil, water, and air quality, what's left is no longer livable, or as the saying goes, there are no jobs on a dead planet. Some of the strategies that environmental unionists use are to make ecological demands on climate change part of the union's quest for good jobs. B, At the company level, work for occupational safety and promote vouchers for public transit. And these are just a few ideas. And C, collective bargaining level to work for shorter hours, more green unionism, education, and training. That's environmental unionism to a great extent. I can't go into it more because, as I said, it would be a book.
It would be a college lecture at that point, yeah.
Environmental racism is a little easier to define because it's narrower. First, it's a type of systemic racism, penetrating virtually all of the systems here in the U.S. But to address the environmental part, there are several components. Polluting and extractive and toxic industries who locate where land tends to be cheaper and property values are lower. This places them most often in poor communities, occupied most often by people of color, marginalized people, and the indigenous. Then these populations suffer the health consequences of these polluting industries. And if they're fortunate enough to actually have been able to buy their homes instead of renting, the value of their homes plummet. And then in the case of the indigenous people on reservation land, they cannot move in many circumstances, partly because of their spiritual beliefs. They've been put on that land to take care of that land, and to leave the land is to abandon their spiritual directive.
Right. And also on reservations, a lot of that land is held in good faith by the government as well, especially in larger reservations.
So, a couple things. I mentioned at the very beginning a shiro of mine, and that would be Judy Berry.
Mm-hmm.
And Judy Berry, I was hoping that Al would be here because I wanted him to go on at great length about her history.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have it here, so I'm hoping people will jump in.
But Al knew her.
Yeah, he knew her and worked with her. But Judy Berry was born November 7th, 1949, and she died this month in 1997 on March 2nd. And she actually died of breast cancer, but anyhow, she was one of the very first environmental warriors. She got involved in California with preserving the old growth redwoods. She started an organization called Earth First. Her genius was that rather than seeing people who were working for environmental justice at odds with the loggers, by putting spikes in the trees that could injure the loggers, she wanted to bring the loggers into the movement with the Earth Firsters and the environmentalists. So that's where the climbing up the trees and sitting in the trees to protect them rather than spiking the logs came about. I don't have her full history, and if I did, I don't have time to tell it here, but solidarity for Judy Berry, Earth First, died March 2nd, 1997. So I also wanted to talk about Earth Day, which is April 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
And that was developed in 1970 by Senator Gaylord Nelson. We now have, of course, Earth Month, all of the month of April. But prior to the first Earth Day, 1970, we had no Environmental Protection Agency, no Clean Air Act, no Clean Water Act, no legal or regulatory environmental protections at all. And this year's theme for Earth Day is invest in our planet, which God knows we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to talk about that. The expression environmental racism, I wanted to go back to that, was first used in 1982 by a man called Benjamin Chavis, Chavis. He was the past executive director of the United Church of Christ in North Carolina, a black man. It was in, what county was it? Warren County. And he coined that term, environmental racism, to describe the toxic dumping of corporations of PCBs into the groundwater supply and the land, the farming land in North Carolina. So we can thank Benjamin Chavez for that. So I just wanted to let people know. And I think I talked about environmental racism, but I wanted to stress the fact that it was institutional or systemic racism. Mm-hmm. We're talking in this case also about extractive economies. So they put the burden, this is internationally or anywhere, the environmental burdens of mining and oil extraction and industrial agricultural practices, all of that, on poor nations and people of color and indigenous people. And so when a company or corporation, I'm going to say international mega corporation, goes to Nigeria and extracts gold or oil, decimates everything and leaves, that's environmental racism. And it's built into the structure that we have currently in the United States. So Earth Day coming up, and Earth Month coming up.
Yes, fellow worker Gordon?
Just to inform the listeners, fellow worker Marilyn talked earlier about Judy Barry.
Thank you.
And her name is spelled B-A-R-I.
Yes.
Okay, so if you're trying to look her up, Judy Barry, B-A-R-I, she's a very inspirational character because I worked in heavy industry in a toxic male environment, and I know how tough it is to get a lot of working class men, especially, to even admit to any kind of sensitivity or any kind of care for other people or for the planet. Mm-hmm. And she managed to get some of the toughest guys in the workforce, the loggers, you know, to at least put their chainsaws down and listen to the environmentalists and vice versa, because they wanted to put food on the table and to demonize people trying to work for a living.
And I also wanted to tell the listener that one of our fellow members nationally, Steve Ongarth, has written a book called Redwood Uprising that tells the story of Judy Barry and Earth First. And he's at IWW Local 1.
Thank you. And thank you so much for that report.
There's also the Blue-Green Alliance. There's so much about this. The Blue-Green Alliance was an attempt a while back, and it's still going on, to continue the work of educating environmental or ecological disaster people and industry that they are not against each other,
right,
to work together.
The blue referring to blue-collar workers.
Blue-collar workers and
the
green. Blue-Green Alliance.
Excellent.
Yeah. So that's something the listener can check out, Google it. Mm-hmm. We used to have a branch here. I don't know if we still do.
Mm-hmm. Earth First, you mean?
No, Blue-Green Alliance.
Blue-Green Alliance.
Yeah.
I think it kind of faded because I haven't heard about it in a long time.
I know some history.
It probably melded in with 350 Tacoma, I would imagine.
No, it didn't. But some of the people are still, you know, they've made the transition.
Coming up to the conclusion of our show here, just going to go over some local events, previous and upcoming. Fellow worker Gordon, you previously mentioned the Charleston Movie Theater Night for Bread and Roses. Could you give us the time and location for that one more time?
Certainly. It's going to be May Day, which is Monday, May 1st. And our doors are going to open at 6:30 p.m. And the movie starts at 7 p.m. And that's the Charleston Theater on Callow Avenue in Bremerton, Washington. So you can look them up. They've got a webpage. And it's an all-ages type setup. They have a bar up in the Lowe's. That's where I'll be. And young kids can come in legally if you bring in your kids to, you know, a concert or to the venue or to the movie. And if you want further information, you can call fellow worker Sean at 360-471-5982. And also you can ask him questions about the March 31st meeting at 6 p.m. at 3650 Kitsap Way. And that's about starting a real estate cooperative. In other words, becoming an entity for cooperative housing that's legal and that we can purchase a piece of land and have it in the proper zones and in the proper permitting process so we can build alternative architecture, passive solar powered, And we actually have a consultant going on for that. So these are two big projects that you can find out about and get your feet wet, as it were, and help the struggle for a fair society.
Just to give a couple brief announcements of upcoming events from myself. First and foremost, there is a recognition rally for the Tacoma Art Museum workers who are trying to form a union. There is a recognition rally on March 23rd. There's a link to sign up online. The Tacoma Art Museum Union, these workers are being organized with Council 28 of the AFSCME, or AFSCME. That's the Washington Federation of State Employees. Their union is TAM Workers United, and they would really love for you to come out on March 23rd, directly across the street from the Tacoma Art Museum, to rally for voluntary recognition from the Board of Trustees at the Art Museum. So please show up if you can.
Is that Tollefson Plaza?
Tollefson Plaza, yes.
Yeah, and that's state, county, and municipal workers.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is.
And then I wanted to make a comment about the event in Bremerton. If you workers, if you listeners out there show up at the event, let us at IWW or WOB Radio, let us know that you're there, that you're hearing us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And I have one too.
Go ahead, fellow worker Marilyn.
Okay. So coming up Monday, March 13th, and I hope we can get this on the air in time.
Probably not.
Oh, well, Medea Benjamin, founder of Code Pink, will be in Tacoma. It's a free event. She'll be speaking at Tacoma Community College Monday, March 13th at 6 p.m., Student Center, Building 11. And the topic is Ukraine Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. And those of you who are listening may know who Medea is. She is an anti-war advocate, mm-hmm. So you might get to hear something that presents a different attitude than you've been hearing.
Quite an effective firebrand.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah.
And also, I'd like to announce another event here taking place in the Tacoma area. Tacoma for All is an organization that is a housing justice campaign aimed at building Tacoma's working class movement and winning policies, including a social housing developer and tenants' bill of rights. They are having canvassing events in order to get an initiative on the ballot for this tenants' bill of rights here in the city of Tacoma. This would include things like protections from unlawful or unfair evictions, unfair or short-term raises in rent or utility costs.
There's 10 items.
Right, there's a whole 10-item list that they have, and they want this tenant's bill of rights to be approved by the city of Tacoma via a ballot initiative. We encourage you to reach out to Tacoma for All on Facebook. You could also reach out to us at the Tacoma branch of the IWW. You could reach out to the Tacoma branch of the Democratic Socialists of America, and they can help you get set up so that you can help canvass for this initiative. This is really important for people living in Tacoma who are renters, which is quite a lot of us. And this Bill of Rights would be really important to protect working class people from unfair evictions, raises in rent, and so forth. So please reach out to them. They could really use the assistance. Any other announcements by chance?
Just a little slogan to tack on to your announcement. Remember that most renters are workers, and vice versa. Most workers are renters.
Absolutely.
So supporting just housing is very much in the wheelhouse of our kind of union organizing, because our kind of union organizing also takes care of the workers and the community.
Thank you so much, fellow worker Gordon. Looks like that's just about the conclusion of our show today. We just want to thank our fellow listeners currently tuning in to KTAH 101.9 Radio Tacoma FM. And we would also like to announce that this will be our first episode with KTQA 95.3 FM here in Tacoma as well. So thank you so much for tuning in. Please find us at Facebook at WOB Radio. You can reach out to the Tacoma branch of the IWW if you're interested in becoming a union member. And we hope to see you on the airwaves again soon.
And that's WOB Radio, W-O-B Radio.
Yes, W-O-B Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in. And solidarity.
Solidarity forever.
Solidarity.
There is power in a band of working men when they stand, hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. One industrial union grand.